Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Today's guest on the Mike Wise Show started at center 2 straight years in the NBA Finals against none other than Shaquille O'Neal. He's one of the most self-aware and funny athletes I've ever known. The story he tells today about how he got on the Dave Chappelle Show is beyond hilarious. And he's now a professional pinball player, one of the best storytellers around. I promise. We'll introduce you to him. But ladies first, Darlene, do your thing.
The Mike Wise Show is a presentation of Pure Hoops Media. The Mike Wise Show is hosted by a guy who played basketball atrociously for Hawaii Pacific College, which forced him into journalism. And, oh yeah, he wrote about basketball for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and ESPN. He's also a wise ass, and so are many of his guests. Right, Mike?
All right, guys, before I get into Todd McCulloch interview, I want to address this controversy in the NBA with China. I think it's the biggest brouhaha I've been a part of in my 25, 30 years covering the league. And, I mean, that surpasses Jordan retiring, the lockouts, the malice in the palace, when the Pistons and Pacers brawled with fans, all that stuff. This is bigger than anything, and I'm going to tell you why. By NBA social justice standards, it reads like an almost innocuous tweet. Fight for freedom, stand with Hong Kong. That was Daryl Morey's tweet. But because he's the general manager of the Houston Rockets, the most popular team in China since Hall of Fame center Yao Ming played there, those two sentences may go down as the most expensive two sentences in the 3-decade history of the internet. And that's not an exaggeration. Sports business analysts are saying this could cost the NBA $1.5 billion or more, that it's already devalued franchises by millions and is expected to affect future salary caps and could very well end the NBA's 30-year relationship with mainland China. And it's all because a team official showed solidarity with some of the world's voiceless, people who want independence from a brutal authoritarian government. That government, as we now know, condemned that tweet. Adam Silver's delayed support for freedom of expression and any support for democratic reform in Hong Kong. Mainland China, we now know if we didn't already, has two ways to do things, their way and the wrong way. Now, as Chinese businesses refuse to sell NBA products, state television has canceled NBA games and this barnstorming preseason tour to China, which includes LeBron and the Lakers and the Brooklyn Nets, by the way, that's been marred by a real geopolitical crisis. Adam Silver, a guy I like, respect, and peripherally have known for like 25 years, has had to answer the most seminal question of his stewardship. Is it still okay to be this woke if my league starts to go broke? I mean, that's what it comes down to. His original response was no. The NBA originally took issue with Morey's tweet, said it doesn't represent the league. James Harden showing how unaware and uneducated many players are with China's atrocious human rights record actually apologized to the government on behalf of the Rockets for Morey's tweet, essentially saying, sorry, Beijing, we don't support those ingrates in Hong Kong who want independence from your undemocratic nation. New Nets owner Joseph Tsai, a Canadian-Taiwanese businessman, verbally smacked Morey too. He minimized Chinese oppression by using a Facebook post to give a condescending history lesson on territorialism in China. Steve Kerr's response blew me away the most. Kerr, who, look, I've known forever, just a good person before he's a great coach. You know, he's gone after a sitting U.S. president for his racial insensitivity, and his team has twice refused to attend a Trump White House champion celebration. But he went mute on the NBA China divide when first asked, pleading ignorance. And, you know, to be honest, it was as if Chinese officials had originally scripted the NBA's response. And it had to be simply this: We disavow any connection to that rogue idiot in Houston who thinks the province of mainland China deserves to be free. Beijing basically said, shut up and dribble, and LeBron and the league shut up and dribbled. Remember, these are the same athletes and coaches who not only boycotted trips to the White House, but they wore Black Lives Matter t-shirts before games in solidarity for young African-American children wrongly killed by law enforcement. Everybody in the NBA, it seems, was down for the cause unless it conflicted with their wallets. And of all ironies, for at least 24 or 48 hours, most people in the NBA supported communism because it helped their own capitalism. Think about that. But I will give Adam Silver this. The commissioner got wise within a day. Facing incredibly ugly backlash at home, he quickly issued support for Morey in his second and third statements released by the league, and thereby alienated the Chinese government. And even though it appeared as if he was putting his finger in the wind and deciding which way the economic winds blew, doesn't matter. The commissioner came to his senses, and the owners have now become resigned to the notion that it's better to piss off people buying sneakers in Beijing than in Boise or Bangor or wherever the hell in America you buy your shoes. I'm not going to eviscerate the players anymore or the officials of the NBA for showing hypocrisy in this matter before doing an about face. I just don't want to hear how they remind us all of Muhammad Ali and Arthur Ashe, who went to South Africa at the height of apartheid to protest. That generation of change agents made it possible for this generation of change agents to speak their minds. They didn't care about the dollars. They were all about dignity. They sacrificed everything for what was right. So if there's one lesson to take away from this, it's that we don't get to be part-time social justice warriors when we sign up for this kind of work. We don't get to be outraged against blackface and then plead ignorance when some warped Cleveland Indians fan wears red face and a logo that looks like a Native American Sambo caricature. We don't get to be selective advocates speaking up for some of the voiceless, but not all. We need to self-educate with the people we do business with and understand that if their values run so counterculture to our own, then maybe it's time we either got out of the Beijing business or the social conscience business. Because when it comes to a place like China, you can't be both. All right. Thanks for letting me get on my high horse. Here's Todd McCulloch.
Full stop.
Thanks, Darlene. Today's guest is Todd McCulloch. I got to see him play in his prime. It was probably my prime as a writer, too. So, Todd, thank you for getting up so early in Seattle, Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm glad to be here. Anytime's a good time for Mike Wise.
Hey, Todd, your kids are sleeping right now, right?
Kids are sleeping right now and got a little time before we got to get them up, get some lunches made, and get them off to school where they belong.
How old are they?
11 and 9.
Oh, man, you're in the thick of it. I'm an old dad. I got 9, 4, and 20 months. It's crazy.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's that'll keep you busy.
Now you, pardon my ignorance, you grew to 6'11"?
6'11 and 13'16". Didn't quite make 7 feet. nobody likes a quitter, but I just couldn't quite make it to that level. But 7-footers are slow and plodding, so 6'11 and a half are agile and flea of foot, so it's okay that I stopped there.
You, I look at the league now, and it's crazy to me. Not that the center position has completely been legislated out of the game, but I had the good fortune of writing Shaq's autobiography like 20 years ago, and all he talked about was inside outside. And if you don't have a big man in this league, and now it's like everybody's chucking from the parking lot. Do you even recognize the same NBA that you played in?
Not really. And I have those same questions that you did about whether a guy like me with my skill set would be able to play in the modern NBA. And I can't remember who I was talking to somebody about, you know, what it used to be like. And it used to be maybe you'd have trouble, you would have trouble guarding, you know, big centers, traditional back to basket centers, but in a different way. But every now and then, you know, guys like Kevin Garnett would come in the league, and now I'm trying to guard Kevin Garnett on the perimeter, and he can put the ball on the floor, and he can dribble, and he can dunk, and he can shoot threes, and that would be an extreme challenge. But that was kind of on a rare night where you had to play someone, you know, as talented and gifted at this height. And then now I feel like every team has one or two of those guys. And I'm just thinking for a guy like myself to be out there trying to guard somebody like Porzingis with that skill set at that height, you know, guys like Durant, I am really impressed. I mean, I always thought I was coordinated, but the things that those guys can do with the ball handling, the passing, and their leaping ability is absolutely incredible to me, what they can do at this height. There seems to be no limit to their skill set.
I mean, I just remember being all of 6'4 and a half, maybe 6'5 before my disc slipped. That growing up, when I was 12, my folks moved to Hawaii, and 6'5 is a big man in Hawaii. I had to play center, and they would almost wait for me to run down the court like they did the Chief in One Floor of the Cuckoo's Nest. And now if I shot from far away, if I didn't make it, I was almost taken out of the game. Nowadays, I mean, if you can't shoot from three and you're 6'11", 7 foot, you're almost it's a disadvantage.
Yeah, you're kind of a dinosaur. I know my dad always wanted me to. He always wanted me to hit a three, and it wasn't expected of me, and it wasn't something that I needed to do. But one of my high school coaches thought it would be funny if in an all-star game he ran me off a double screen to try and get me a three. He thought it'd be funny. It was almost like a novelty, like, hey, let's get the 7-footer open. So he runs me off a double screen off the baseline, and I'd never come off a screen in my life. All I've done is set screens, and I come off and I expect to be open after this double screen, but I wasn't that hard to guard. And then when I caught the ball, you know, ready to shoot, the guy was right there in my face, and so I had to double clutch it. Like, I went up, I pumped and tried to shoot a one-armed three, and it didn't go in. We ran the play a couple more times, and the coach said, you know what, it's not funny anymore, stop shooting threes, like, it's the novelty is over. And then in my last college game against I think it was against Washington State, and I had not hit a three or taken a three in college basketball. And then in one of the last timeouts, one of my assistant coaches came up to me. He's like, Todd, if you get a look, you can jack one up from three. And I said, really? Did coach say it's okay? He goes, hell no. And if you told him I said he could, I'll kill you. You do not have his permission, but I'm just telling you, if you get open, jack one. So it never quite happened for me.
Did you win that game?
Oh, it was the Cougars. Of course we won. Yeah.
Cougars beat Wazoo. That's a huge game up there.
It's a good rivalry, but we came up on top of that one.
Yeah. All right. No, the Huskies beat Wazoo. That's what I meant.
The Huskies beat Wazoo.
Yep. So we're talking with Todd McCullough, the retired NBA center, who's one of the most candid voices, outside of the game. You'll say anything, right? So the great thing about this program is you can swear, you can, you know, whatever you want to do for ratings, I need them. So you go for it. I mean, it's, but you, oh, what I want to say is you're from Winnipeg, Manitoba, obviously home to Canadian hockey country, and you grew up a basketball player, and you have a real international portfolio, having played internationally for Canada.
Before that 2000 Sydney Olympics, the last time the Canadian national men's team had made the Olympics was 1988, when our coach Jay Triano was a player. And I don't think Canada has been back to the Olympics since 2000. So that was it was a special team. And of course, when you have a guy like Steve Nash, he makes everybody better. And we don't think there were super high expectations for our team. Our goal at first was to just qualify, because it's you know, of the 12 countries that make it, it's an achievement just to do it. So that was our goal. And then it was kind of like, all right, guys, now that goal was last summer. We're there now. If we're, you know, if you're going there and we're not trying to medal, then we're, this is not just a vacation. This is not just it's going to be a wonderful experience, but let's see what we could do. And we started off with a win against host Australia, which really surprised people and got some people excited back home. And then we beat a good Spanish team, and that got people pretty fired up. And then I think we beat Angola after that, and then we sort of kind of made a mental mistake. We just the goal was to finish of the six teams in each pool, two were eliminated after round robin play, and the goal was to not be fourth, because if you're fourth, you're going to cross over, you're going to meet the great American team, and you're going to be out of the medal round. So the goal was, you know, first, second, or third in our pool. And we sort of took Russia kind of lightly. We were rolling, and
that's it. Now I remember.
And we ended up losing. Actually, I remember for some reason we had talked about it before the game and said, okay, if we guys, as long as we win or lose by less than 16, we're fine. And I think mentally that stuck in our head, and we approached the game differently than we had the other ones. We thought, well, we can probably beat Russia, and if we don't, we're not going to lose by 16. And sure enough, here we are. We're down by 14 in the closing seconds, and then Russia hits a shot to go up by 16, and it was almost like a tie game at that point. And we were feeling the pressure, and Nash took a shot at the buzzer, and we missed it. And we knew what happened if we won by less than 16, and we knew what would happen if it was more. We didn't know what happened if we'd lost by exactly 16. And so basically, everybody talked and said, "Oh, Canada's blown it. They lost to Russia, and with the points for and against, Australia is going to advance, you know, assuming Canada loses to Yugoslavia, which they will, and they're going to be fourth, and they'll be eliminated by the U.S. This is what some of the people in the papers were saying. And our coach and sports psychologist kind of said, "Hey, guys, if we go out and beat Yugoslavia, let's finish first in our pool. How about that? Let's shock everybody." So we went out and beat Yugoslavia the next night, which, you know, typically doesn't happen a lot in basketball. We finished first in the pool and then made it to the crossover round, and unfortunately ran into a red-hot team from France, lost by 5, and were relegated to the 7th-8th place game. So we went in a really nice role, and there was a lot of excitement brewing in Canada behind that national team. And, of course, Vince Carter was a super exciting player, did a lot for basketball in Canada, and really got a lot of those young players thinking about the future and had a big impact on the type of player that's coming out of Canada right now.
Well, and he leaped over Frederick Weiss in that game that I covered, and I was like, I never saw anything like that in person. It was incredible.
We were getting ready for a game. We were playing later that night, and so we were in a house full of basketball players and a couple of male beach volleyball players, and I come down to the room, and it's just a raw feed. It's just some camcorder set up on the basketball feed. So I'm sitting down there putting on my shoes, watching the game, you know, the U.S. versus France, and I'm down there by myself. None of my teammates are down there getting ready yet. And I see the play, and with my own eyes, I see it. And I think, did I just see what I think I saw? That's the most amazing dunk ever. But no announcers, no replay, no, just a raw live feed like it never happened. And I'm watching this going, I want to see the replay. Like, no one's freaking out. No one's saying. And then one by one, my teammates would come down, and I'd say, "Hey, guys, you just missed the best dunk in the history of basketball." And they're like, "Whatever, Todd, you're excited." I'm like, "No, you guys know Frederick Weiss? Yeah, he's my height." And Vince just jumped over, and they're like, "Well, he couldn't have jumped over him. He might have jumped beside him or something." I'm like, "No, I'm telling you, you guys will see the play, and it's unbelievable." So they, history showed that I was right. And a few years later, I was in Atlantis in the Bahamas, about to go down that slide where you get a free enema. I don't know if you go right through a shark tank. And I'm standing there, and this guy's like, "Hey, didn't you play in the Sydney Olympics?" I said, "Yes, I did." He's like, "Yeah, Vince Carter jumped over you. You're Frederick Weiss." I'm like, "No, I'm not. I'm not Frederick Weiss. I played. I've been mistaken for him," which was, you know.
That's where you do the whole, like, what do all us white guys look alike that are 7 feet? That's, like, crazy.
All us 7-footers. Yeah.
Yeah. Tom McCulloch's my guest. The reason I thought that you had a disappointing run and you didn't was because I remember the writers at the time, Bruce Arthur and Doug Smith, longtime Canadian basketball guys. They were just depressed. I remember they're depressed in Sydney. And I thought, gosh, and they felt like, you know, you guys were on a roll, you could medal. But either way, the fact that you went that far. Yao Ming was drafted in 2002. He played. What was he like early on? I mean, how was it tough to guard him? Was it?
Yes, it was. He was great. He was a gentle giant and just a total class act. So it was a pleasure to play against him. A lot of guys at that height are pretty skinny. And he always had a solid base. He had, you know, big, strong legs and wide shoulders. So not only was he, was he 7'6" and 6 inches taller than me, but he also had, really broad shoulders, took up a lot of space, and had a beautiful touch. And so he was extremely tough to guard, and not surprised that he went on to the kind of career that he did. And I'm sad that his career got cut short, because he was doing great things and was going to do that for quite a bit longer. So it was fun to play against him, just to see, you know, you had to try and beat him up and down the floor a little bit and try and try and go from A to B a little bit, you know, like you were talking about, Chief, with One Floor with the Cuckoo's Nest. I used to joked that that was my style as well. Just go park myself under there. So it was fun to play against him, and he was a class act, and really cool to see him inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame.
Do you keep in touch with him at all?
Don't keep in touch with Yao Ming, you know, with Steve Nash a little bit, and some of those guys, Kyle Korver. I think with the NBA not being in Seattle currently, I think not having that face to face with former teammates and keeping the friendships going with the ability at least once a year to go out, I think I've lost track of a lot of my teammates. Had a lot of great experiences and loved all of them, but I don't stay in touch with as many as I would like. I've reconnected with George Lynch a little while ago, and every now and then somebody will pop up and we'll check in with each other. But I hope everybody's doing well.
Todd McCullough is my guest. He's by now you're pretty much Seattle, Washington native. Are you an American citizen?
I am. I'm a U.S. citizen and a Canadian citizen, and happy to be here, and really like the Northwest. It seemed very Canadian when I came down here on a recruiting visit, and it just seemed like home. And it's not that far from the Canadian border, so it's nice to go up and visit my pops and have him be able to come down and visit the grandkids. So the Northwest is definitely home for this guy.
Do you see Jamal Crawford around at all?
It's been a while. I've always enjoyed running into Jamal Crawford and really been proud. He used to come and work out with us when I was at the University of Washington, and he would come and just his skill set, his agility, his passing. I was like, wow, this kid is going to be really good. And he's
even when he was young.
Oh yeah, even when he was young. I think he was just still in high school from Rainier Beach, and he used to come over and just light us up and just be threading the needle. And I sure love playing with guys that love to pass the basketball. So I haven't seen him around the city very much. Saw Brandon Roy a little while ago and had a nice little chat with him, and it was really cool to see how well he did at the University of Washington. And it was a shame that his NBA career got cut short, because he was an amazing talent as well. So there's some really good players here, and University of Washington is starting to keep some of those local guys and really build the program up here.
It's a crime that Seattle doesn't have a franchise. It's such a great, not only just a great city, but a great basketball town. I believe you played in the Doug Christie and later the Jamal Crawford Pro-Am, right? The Seattle Pro-Am for a while.
I never played. I used to work out with some of those guys, but I never played in that a lot of organized stuff.
You could tell I've really read Bruce Bernstein's notes on all the research I was supposed to do for your career. This is great, Bruce. My fault. but Todd, so this is the crazy part, and I've wanted to talk to you about this, I think, more than anything else. I grew up on pinball. I'm 12 years older than you, but I grew up on pinball. You still play. This thing is like talk about dinosaurs. With video games, this thing's just become one of these things that just sort of like went by the wayside. We don't even talk about pinball anymore. You still play in tournaments. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. I got
something right. This is good.
I'm playing in a tournament tonight. I'm going to an arcade bar here in the Seattle area called Flip Flip Ding Ding, if you can imagine what that place is all about. There's about 25 pinball machines in there, and my friend Bowen Cairns is in town. He's a Bostonian who's a 5 or 6 time world champion. I didn't meet him at that time. I was playing for the Nets and trying to prove my worth, and I was being heckled by a mathematician up in the upper stands, and I didn't hear him specifically. I heard a lot of Boston fans yelling at me. I made the free throws. We won the game. And a couple years later, I was heading up to Boston, and I found out that this 6-time pinball world champion was a Boston resident, and asked her friend, like, hey, do you think Bowen would show me a few things? He's like, dude, he's like the nicest guy ever. So I reach out to him, like, hi, Bowen, my name is Todd McCullough. I work for the Philadelphia 76ers as a radio analyst, and I was wondering if I supplied you with a couple of tickets to a game, if you would maybe show me a few things. And so it picked me up, And we went to a buddy's house, and he just showed me some things and blew me away. And he's like, I got to apologize. A couple of years ago, I heckled you, and I yelled at you, and I'm really
sorry. I was that guy.
Yeah, he was that guy. So he's in town, and when he's in town, we usually go out to Flip Flip Ding Ding and play in a Thursday night tournament. So in the Seattle area, basically every night of the week, there is a pinball tournament where you'll go and compete against 15 to 50 other pinheads. So because it's Thursday, we're going to flip, flip, ding, ding. Last time we went, Bowen, it's three strikes, you're out. So you just go and sign up. And they'd say, you know, Todd, you and Bowen are playing this game, and hopefully I don't get matched up against against him right away. And if you win, you don't get an X, and if you lose, you get an X. And after three strikes, you're out. And so it was 1:15 in the morning. The last ferry back to Bainbridge Island was 1:35, and Bowen was still alive in the three strike out tournament. I'm like, buddy, if you want to crash with me on Bainbridge, we need to leave now. Otherwise, we're going to miss the boat. So he cashed out on fourth place prize money. I think he got 10 or 15 bucks and got his entry fee back. And then. And then so the next time he's like, next time I'm going to crash with the Seattle buddy. That way I don't have to leave. And so at 1:45 in the morning, he was crowned the champion of the flip-flip tournament. And, yeah, so he's something to watch. He's like the LeBron James or the Michael Jordan of pinball, and it's just it's incredible. So
how could you – this is a hobby more than it is a profession, right? I mean, I saw you won a $3,000 cash prize once in Chicago.
That's my best winning. I won 2,000 at another tournament. So my total prize winnings are probably $7,000 or something like that. So it's not these aren't big money tournaments. So although it's getting a little bigger, this the big tournament in Pittsburgh went through the summer. We had 1,000 competitors. So Bowen started this tournament 9 years ago with 172 players, and it's now up to 1,000 players. Each year it becomes the world's largest tournament. And next year it might be more. So it is growing. People are starting to catch on. So even though it was a dinosaur and it was dying, there's something changing. There's just a small groundswell, and it's not the video game one with the modern gladiators playing in front of esports stadiums. It's not that, but it is growth, and there is more excitement, and there's more manufacturers, and there's more games, and there's more. There's every week I look at the websites and see different pinball bars opening up, and so I'm loving the fact that people are starting to realize this game is still fun, and they're using advancements to increase your movie clips and good audio and magnets and ramps and craziness. So it's taken the same game, and it's just making it more interesting, and I can't get enough of it. So there's a whole bunch of interesting characters in the game.
Do you have a go-to pinball machine, like one you just sort of gravitate toward, a game that in particular? Mine used to be something like Dreamweaver or something. It was like from the 70s.
My favorite game is probably Medieval Madness from 1997. It's kind of a take on it's kind of like Monty Python. It's kind of irreverent, and they took our shoes. They took our historical monuments. They took our pinball machine.
It's just a bunny.
It's got big teeth. When thou get to
Did you ever play Deadpool, the arcade game, the pinball machine Deadpool?
It's in my basement, so I don't know when you want to come over and play.
I've got
Star Wars. So what else is down? Game of Thrones is down there. The Walking Dead is down there. We got a Ghostbusters game now based on that great film. So they're taking all these cool things from the 80s and bringing them back. And yeah, you gotta come play. It's really fun.
I was gonna tell you, Bainbridge Island. Is that where you live?
Yeah, Bainbridge Island, a little cottage community away from Seattle. Yeah.
It's one of my fondest memories. During the 96 finals, the Seattle Supersonics, Gary Payton and Sean Kemp in that group, were kind enough to steal the last two games in Seattle when we thought they were going to get swept. And they ended up losing in six, of course. But they had to, but because we stayed in Seattle for a few more days. I think it was me, Frank Isola from the New York Daily News, and I was at the New York Times. We just took a ferry over to Bainbridge Island, rented bikes, went to wineries. Oh my God, this thing's like a paradise away from the mainland. It was incredible.
Yeah, it's a really fantastic community, and that seems like the secret is out. So there's there's a lot of growth, and people are moving here, and then traffic's getting a little worse, and so you're stopped at a. You got to be careful though, because there's all these. It's changing a little bit. People are starting to cut each other off, and you're like, hey, you son of a. Oh, you're my daughter. You're my daughter's class. Hi, we'll see you on the play date on Thursday. Like, you got to be careful, because you're yelling at people, and you're like, oh, that's the principal of my kid's school, so I better watch it. So yeah, it's cool. Wineries. We got a brewery and. And yeah,
oh, it's Bainbridge really, has really exploded. Well, there was almost nothing there when I was last there.
It's growing. So I do love it here. I like being one of the locals, just interacting with the nice folks here. It's a great place to live. Very, very.
Do you do any salmon fishing?
I do. I go up with my pops. He lives on Vancouver Island, and he's got a fishing boat. And I used to talk to Todd Wright, and he was doing some basketball analysis, and I was be on my boat with my dad, and he's like, son, you know, you're out here fishing, you can't be doing sports interviews. I'm like, come on, Dad, there's like 8 hours of time in between the fish catching here. And so I caught a bald eagle with him once a couple of years ago. We were up fishing on off of Vancouver Island, and I had a little swimmer, that's a little salmon on your line that you know, you catch by accident, and this bald eagle thought that looked pretty tasty. So he's trying to get at my swimmer on the end of my line. I'm trying to move my rod so he doesn't get it, but the eagles are
smart. And you hooked him?
Well, he hooked himself, so he's trying to get my little fish that I'm trying to get off my line, and I'm trying to whip it around to so he can avoid it. But he's smart, and he sees when I whip the rod where the fish ends up, so he fakes like he's going for it. I whip it, and he grabs this little salmon with my hook still in it and starts flying off. I'm like, Dad, I caught a bald eagle. He's like, son, we'll go to jail for that. So fortunately, he grabbed the rod, and the fish was like, or the bird decided that this little salmon shouldn't have weighed about 800 pounds, and decided there's something fishy about this. Let him go. And I fortunately, the bald eagle flew.
Oh, that's true. We used to clean our salmon guts and throw them off the boat, and the bald eagles would come right behind us and eat them. When we were catching can Alaska once, my dad and me, it was incredible. Yeah, I know. I just found out in the States you can get a 5,000 fine and up to a year in prison for killing a bald eagle. But I mean, if it was an accident and you could prove that he took the bait, I don't see how they could put you in prison. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and you were in Canada. It's not even a national bird.
What's the national bird
in Canada? The
mosquito.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, there's a lot of those bad boys.
Todd McCullough is my guest. He could obviously do his own podcast and stand up. I feel like I'm just basically the warm-up act for him every time he speaks. He had 4,599 points in the NBA, averaged 10.6 per game, 4.2 rebounds, was, for Matt, in my book, an invaluable center, the time that he spent with the 76ers and the Nets. And I just remember it must have been the 2001 finals when basically Larry Brown was throwing you guys out there like Dikembe Mutombo, Todd McCullough. Who else was on your roster that was 7 foot?
We had Matt Geiger, Tyrone Hill, Nazi Muhammad.
And the whole thing was like, let's just not get emasculated by Shaquille O'Neal in the finals. And I tell you what, I love Shaq. I think he's a great guy. He got away with murder in those finals. He was ducking his shoulder into everybody.
He's good at what he does, and we were trying to throw different bodies at him. And I think it was one of those games, and I was sitting on the bench next to Pepe Sanchez, the great Argentinian who played at Temple, and we're sitting there, and Shaq is mowing through all of our big guys. He's getting them all in foul trouble, and Pepe's like, hey, Todd, are you ready? Yeah, you got to get ready. You're going to go in there, and Shaq's going to hurt you. Be careful. I'm like, what do you mean? He's not going to hurt me. It's not the MMA. It's basketball. He might dunk on me, but he's not going to hurt me. He's like, I think he's going to hurt you. I'm like, Todd, get in there. So I get in for Geiger, and then I'm in perfect rebounding position on the far side of the rim. Ball comes up, and I'm textbook. I got him on my back. I'm figuring out the physics of where this ball is going to come out, and I jump up to get it. And he jumps up quicker, higher, gets the ball, comes down with an elbow, and inadvertently pinches a nerve in the Vulcan death grip in my neck. I go down to the ground. He dunks on someone else, gets the and one. The coach is yelling, Todd, what are you doing? I stand up with a pinched neck, and I'm like, sorry, coach, what? And Pepe's like, I told you he'd hurt you. I'm like, Pepe, you shut up. Sorry, coach, what were you saying? So Shaq, by accident, he came down. He was a class act, and most guys you have to – I joke about this with my kids a little bit. Most guys you have to counter. Like if you make a move and you run into a big guy like myself,
yeah,
you got to maybe spin or you know, Olajuwon and, you know, do the dream shake. But Shaq, he's just like, I'm coming. I'm coming, I'm sliding, I'm shifting, and you can't stop him from shimmying in because I'm pushing as hard as I can with all my mass, and I can't slow down his progress, and then you end up under the rim, and then he just dunks on you, and it's like he's playing a different game where he doesn't need a counter. I mean, he had counters, and he could go. And so I can't remember who I was playing against. It was somebody else, and they were making a quick move, and you make that counter, and then you come back. And I still hadn't reacted to the first one, so he made a move and then a counter that I hadn't reacted to, and then he came back thinking it was a double counter, and I was still standing there from the first time, and the guy was like, this guy's all over me. He's an amazing defender. And my son likes the fact that I never left. I'm still here from the first move. If you'd taken the second move, you would have left me in the dust.
Tom McCulloch's my guest. It's been great. We got a few more minutes with him. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, what was the condition that caused you to retire just as you were making big money and establishing yourself as a real legit NBA center?
There was some different different diagnoses. One of them that was Charcot Marie tooth was one that was suggested. I don't think that was actually the the genetic neuropathy. I have neuropathy in both feet from an unknown cause, and so I don't think it has a genetic component to it. And neuropathy affects a lot of different people and comes on for a lot of different reasons. And it was sort of we weren't able to figure out exactly what brought it on.
And so the neuropathy is, it's almost a numbness in the foot, or it's
numbness in some areas and burning in some other ones, and just kind of a general discomfort where the nerves and the soles of your feet are not transmitting the proper information. So I once actually stepped on a small pinball light bulb and had some shards of glass stuck in my foot in a flip-flop, and I went to physical therapy, and she said, do you want me to take this shard of glass out of the bottom of your foot? I'm like, well, I don't feel it, but for in case of infections, you might want to remove it. So a real decreased sensitivity, and it makes it very uncomfortable, as well as makes balance a real problem. And so I'm not feeling the sensations on the bottom of my feet like I should, or like you'd need to be at the top of your game.
You, obviously one of your teammates was Allen Iverson, who is probably the most beloved player, not only of his size, but just because he's so every time he talks lately, it feels like a cathartic moment. And I remember his Hall of Fame speech, people are crying. It was just a confessional. And it was like, it was absolved of all these, whatever you call sins against the game, against society. You come from a completely different world, tall, 6'11" white guy from Winnipeg, Manitoba, and a guy from Hampton Roads, a young African American player, and yet you bonded with that guy, didn't you?
I love that guy, and I didn't know what he would be like, and he was a special player, he was a special person, and he wasn't afraid to be who he was. And I think real is a word that really describes him. And I think when you know who you are, and you like who you are, and you have that kind of talent, I think people are attracted to you, and people want to be around you. They want to be your teammate. You know, the fans loved him, the teammates loved him, and he was an incredible person, and just somebody that was a ton of fun. I mean, he would always keep it light, keep it fun, and he would always play with a fiery. He absolutely hated to lose. You know, he was such an incredible competitor. It absolutely killed him to lose. But I mean, we'd be running around and warm up, and he just made the game so much fun. Mm-hmm. Trying to keep up with him, and he didn't always like getting screens. He kind of liked a little bit of. I mean, he was improvising a lot of the time, and he was just such an incredible talent. You kind of had to let him do it. But sometimes I was trying to play by the book, and if we were doing the offense and secondary, I'd run down, and I'm supposed to set up at the top of the key, but I ended up like running right into Iverson. He's up at the top of the key, breaking down his defender, about to blow by him, and here comes a lumbering Todd McCulloch running to the spot where I was supposed to, and I run into him, trip him, falls, and we turn around. He's like, Todd, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm running the play. I don't know. I'm sorry I ran into you. I apologize. So you had to figure out just how to let him fly and do his thing, because he was virtually unguardable with that with that quick step and the ability to pull up and hit a jump shot. I mean, there's so many ways he could burn you.
If I'm correct, you were, I think you were with the Nets already when he did his famous, we talking about practice rant. Do you remember seeing it? What you thought at the time?
I loved it. I was with the Nets. So I was with them the year before that, and then I was gone for that year, and then I came back, and I remember, you know, they played it a lot then, and they still played a lot. And I remember watching in the locker room when it came on. It was like some of the best press conferences from last year, and just a big smile on his face, and everyone was kind of ribbing him about it. And, you know, we're sitting here talking about practice, not a game. We're sitting here talking about practice. You guys want me to lift weights, man? I won the MVP last year, bony as heck.
All right, real quick, fire. I'm gonna do a lightning round because we only have a couple minutes left with Todd McCulloch. All right, here we go. And you could, it could be one word answer, whatever you're feeling at the time. It's gonna be word association. Let's see. Shaquille O'Neal.
Unstoppable.
Allen Iverson.
Real.
Okay. Mike Wise.
Brilliant.
I love this guy. You got to run my burner account on Twitter. This is true good. Let's see. Steve Nash.
The best. Is that two words? The best.
That's fine. Dave Chappelle, whose show you were on once, by the way.
Do you have time for that story?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so here's the story. I have a friend named Craig Gass, who's a very funny man and a very funny comedian, and we've been friends for a long time since our Seattle days. And he said, "Hey, I'm in New York now, and I'm doing stand up, and I'm performing at the Boston Comedy Club, and I'm wondering if you and any of your teammates want to come out and for a great night of comedy." I said, "Hey, I'm there, and my wife is there, and my friend Pepe Sanchez is there, and his girlfriend at the time, and I'll see who else wants to come." And it was just, you know, me and my wife and Pepe and his girlfriend. And Craig's like, "Yeah, should we get some dinner before?" So we go to a nice restaurant, and I tell Craig, like, "Hey, you know, I've seen his act, and I love his act." So I'm telling him, like, "Hey, do your Yoda." And he's like, "Strong you are. The force is strong in you." So I'm doing my impression of his Yoda, and then I'm like, do your Sean Connery. And he's like, "Yes, are you ready for the Goldfinger?" So I'm doing, you know, his impressions. So I'm doing like my favorite parts of his act. So he's basically done it again. And now it's a great dinner. He's super entertaining. And it's like, "All right, guys, I'm about to be on stage. So let's go. We need to head up to Greenwich Village." All right. So we go in there, and there's a woman up on stage doing stand-up comedy. And there is a couple in the audience. That's it. There's two people, and there's no energy. There's no atmosphere. There's nothing. And Craig is sort of horrified that he's sort of promised this amazing night of comedy, and there's just no atmosphere, and he's about to go on stage, and he's just basically done his whole act at dinner for the four of us, and he's freaking out, and he's like, "Oh man, I need..." Oh, and then the woman's up on stage, and she's just killing time, and she's like, "So, let's see, what else is going on? The Knicks are going to kick the crap out of the Sixers tomorrow night." And the owner goes, "Hey, just so you know, these guys play for the Sixers." And she's like, "Oh, that's my time. I'll see you guys later." And she leaves the stage. And Craig's like, "I need a smoke. I need a smoke." So he goes outside to smoke and de-stress. And somebody rolls down the window of a car that's parked in front of there and said, "Hey, but buddy, can I get a light?" And he's like, "Yeah, sure." And it turns out to be Dave Chappelle. And he's like, "Dave Chappelle?" He's like, "Yeah." He's like, "Dude, you got to help me out. I promised a good night to my friends on the Sixers. Will you please get up there and do a little stand-up?" He's like, "Yeah, let me finish my cigarette. I'll be right in." So Dave Chappelle came in and did about 45
minutes. Wait. Chappelle's just driving by the comedy club?
Or just parked there.
He
was just parked there out front. Yeah. So he gets up and does about 45 minutes of impromptu comedy, and just, you know, was incredible. And so he and Craig became friends, and he said, "Hey, I've got a skit coming out next year, and wondering if maybe, you know, Todd wanted to be a part of it." And so I was like, "Yeah, of course I want to be in a Dave Chappelle skit." And and then I read the script, and I'm like, "Oh, this seems a little risque for me, for this little Canadian boy." So I'm going to politely decline.
Tell people what it was. It was a skit, essentially, where African Americans get their reparations.
Right, so they don't need to show up for those week's games. So the Sixers are playing the Knicks, so it's Todd McCulloch versus Travis Knight, one-on-one. And I win like 59-57, and I get interviewed after. And I was like, "So is there anything different?" I'm like, "Yeah, I get to touch the ball a little more. Is there anything else you notice?" I'm like, "Yeah, now I finally feel like I have a big penis." And he's like, "Welcome to the club, buddy."
Oh, that's great. That's push the envelope comedy that you can't make up. This has been great. I can't thank you for enough. I can't thank you for this enough. When Bruce Bernstein and I say we're going to play pinball with you at some point, that would be great. Can I ask you just one more thing before you go?
Sure.
Okay. At one point I heard, I think it was either on one of our podcasts or another, that was just hilarious when you talked about how Kevin Garnett destroyed the confidence of Nicholas Schiavelli. And I remember, I just want to, what exactly happened there? If you could,
I don't know. I don't know that story. That's not ringing any bells.
Okay. I'm trying to think. Bruce, am I wrong on this?
Mike, you were the one who told the story about Schiavelli coming out as a rookie and Garnett absolutely emasculating him and destroying his confidence forever. But I believe Todd had a story about how KG tried to play some head games with him by making certain noises.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
That's true. Yeah, it was.
What would he do?
He just was making these animal sounds like he was fierce, and it was kind of freaking me out because I hadn't heard anybody, you know, trash talk with animal growling sounds. And so it was a really important inbound pass from the baseline, and I'm the outlet at my own free throw line. And he's like, there's no way he gets this pass. No, there's no way. I'm like, you're probably right. You're freaking me out right now. So, yeah, he was, it was a different form of, different form of trash talk.
I missed that NBA. Thanks for getting up with us early. This was great, man. And I'm telling you, I know you probably tried this. You've done it. If you're not doing stand up or podcast, man, you got other hobbies and you got a life and you got kids. But I think you're really funny and good. It'd be a pleasure to see you take that act somewhere else. Because I think you have so many stories and they're just real and it's not even things you make up.
Well, thank you. It's really nice of you to say. So we'll see what the future holds. But these little kids are taking up a lot of time right now.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm the same way. I don't care. It's overwhelming, but it's awesome.
That's a good way to describe it. It's busy, but it's amazing.
All right, let's go. Time to stick the landing.
Thanks to Todd McCulloch for his great stories and his time. Thanks also to one of my 500 best friends in the whole world, producer Bruce Bernstein. Thanks also to our ace editor, Ben Wolfen, for making me sound better than James Earl Jones, because America's rolled by like an army of steamrollers, erased like a blackboard. But basketball, Ray, basketball's remained the constant. Please check out all the Pure Hoops Media shows. Catch and Shoot each Wednesday. Buckets, Boards, and Blocks with Monica McNutt each Thursday. The Pure Hoops podcast with BJ Armstrong and Eric Newman drops on Friday. And, of course, the Mike Wise Show each Monday. Please rate, review, download, subscribe, tell your friends, and enjoy. Peace out, aloha, and hasta la vista, baby. See ya!
The Mike Wise Show used to be called The Wise Ass Show, but it remains a presentation of Pure Hoops Media.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.